the National Institute of Advanced Studies and the participants to this course. I have great pleasure in welcoming Dr. M.S. Valiathan, who is going to talk to us on advances in biomedicine. He calls it a view from the window. I don't know how far the window is from the actual scene of action. He's the director of Sri Chitra Thirunal Institute for Medical Sciences and Technology. Please note the title, Institute of Medical Sciences and Technology, in Trivandrum. He's also the head of the Department of Cardiovascular and Thoracic Surgery. Dr. Valiathan is a Master in Surgery from University of Liverpool, UK, and Fellow of the Royal College of Surgeons in Cardiovascular and Thoracic Surgery in Canada. He's a member of various academic bodies, professional organizations like Society of Thoracic Surgeons, USA, has been on various committees at the national level. He has, for a long time, I've known him for quite a long time, he has been greatly committed to development of Indian biomedical technology. And his institution is not just a hospital, but a great research center for this in this direction. He has very wide range of interests. He is on the editorial board of Current Science, Arogya, National Medical Journal, Bulletin of Material Sciences, Companion Journal of Material Sciences. His areas of interest are in cardiovascular surgery, endomyocardial fibrosis, and development of biomaterials and bioimplants, on which I'm sure he'll be telling us the latest advances. Dr. Valiathan.
Thank you, Professor Kapoor. Professor Kapoor, distinguished participants and friends, I'm greatly honored to be here this afternoon to give this review. And when I was asked to give a lecture on progress in biomedicine, the subject is so vast, and each person will have his own view of what we call progress. Because progress in biomedicine is a vast pageant, extending over many centuries, covering a very vast area. And the layperson will look upon, he will be dazzled by the enormity of instrumentation, the drama of surgery, and so on. A specialist, a medical scientist, will look at diseases being taken to the molecular level, trying to find answers for problems. An economist will worry about the rising cost of healthcare. Each specialty brings adds to the cost, how to meet this cost. An industrialist will find new opportunities for high profit investment. So each person will look upon this progress in his own, through his own window. I propose to look at it through my own window, and that window is that of a surgeon who has warmed both hands in the fire of surgery for 30 years. And when you look at the progress, where we are today, it is important to know how it all started, how we got here, and where we propose to go. Now, there that historical perspective is very necessary, and that is where I propose to begin. May I have the first slide, please? I have taken the Indian system of medicine and also the European system of medicine. Now, about 500 BC, where we have historically documented evidence. Now, that was the high water mark of Indian system of medicine, which is marked in blue. Now, 1,000 years later, you will find there is already a decline, and it has pretty much remained at that level up to now. In other words, the high water mark was here. Already a decline is visible by 500 AD, and the decline continued to 1000 AD, and thereafter there has been very little of creativity. The creative days were over, and it has remained like that, fossilized more or less. Whereas the Western system of medicine, strangely, also had a peak at this level, and this was the time of Sushruta in India and the time of Hippocrates in Greece. And they also had this decline by 500 AD. There was a great decline in Western medicine. The Dark Ages began. There was very little of creativity, except one small school called Salerno existed in Italy. But By 1400, the Renaissance began, and figures like Vesalius appeared, and it started looking up. And the 18th, 19th centuries, there's a sharp peak, and of course, it has never looked back. Now, there is a basic difference in this, and I propose to cover the Indian medicine this particular phase, and the Western medicine this particular phase. I thought the Dark Age is not of great concern for us when we are talking about progress. Of course, it is of great interest to medical historians, but I shall limit myself to this part mainly, and also to this part of the history of Western medicine in a few brief slides. Next, please. Pardon? 80% of the hymns in the Atharva Veda, they relate to prayers for health, for longevity, and so on. I am not referring to those. Sushruta Samhita is a proper document of Indian medicine. I shall have something to say about it later. But if you look at Manusmriti, which was around 400 AD, already the status of the physician had declined considerably. Because Manu, for example, says, for auspicious functions, you should not invite barbers, you should not invite blacksmiths, you should not invite physicians. Already the physician had dropped considerably. Sushruta's techniques were no longer being practiced by this time. Now, the decline for this is a strange story. There are many reasons for this, many theories, if you like. One was the destruction of the Takshashila, which was the greatest medical university in India. That was destroyed by Mihiragla. That was one reason. The libraries were burnt. And secondly, the advent of Buddhism and the banning or the interdiction of any kind of blood shedding that was looked down upon. So this really affected the growth of surgery. This happened in Europe also because the Pope banned any bloodshed, innocent. That was another reason there also. But in India at any rate, Buddhism and this total banning, forbiddance of violence, shedding of blood, destruction of Takshashila, and our own philosophical growth, which tended to look upon the human body as something dirty, something which will defile. So touching, say, saliva or blood and so on, this was considered as if something highly defiling. So we developed a whole culture which started looking down upon human physiology, and that also affected the growth, particularly of surgery. It became more and more theoretical. It was only looking at the patient and making a diagnosis. It was more or less a no-touch technique. So the growth of the philosophical systems, the advent of Buddhism, the destruction of Takshashila, these are all the reasons which are presently being given for this decline. Certainly, there must be other reasons, but we are not very sure what they are. Now, this is a page from the Sushruta Samhita, just to give you an example of how, and Sushruta, as you know, he flourished in Banaras. He's a historical figure, and I shall have more to say about Sushruta later on, but practically every beginning of every chapter, he says, Yatho vacha Bhagavan Dhanvantari. He claims that he is only quoting whatever was taught to him by Dhanvantari. In other words, there was a historical figure, Dhanvantari. It is very difficult to say whether Dhanvantari was human or divine. But that is how Sushruta Samhita begins every chapter. This is a page from that famous Samhita. Next, please. Now, Sushruta, basically the Samhita deals with all these subjects. It is a massive document. It deals with the wisdom of the body. In other words, a philosophical basis of physiology, if I may put it that way. It deals extensively with anatomy and physiology. I shall have something to say about anatomy later on. It deals with the surgery in very great detail to restore bodily equilibrium. In fact, in 500 BC, that was the only document in the world which dealt with surgical techniques in such great detail. Surgical procedures and instrumentation, and also the training of neophytes. How to train young surgeons. There are very elaborate descriptions in Sushruta Samhita. How to select students, how to train them, the duration of training, how to certify them. All these are mentioned in very great detail. Please do interrupt me anytime you wish to. I'm open to question. Next, please. Now, about surgery in which I have a special interest, Sushruta dealt with the surgical anatomy, the regional anatomy as we call it, in the form of marmas. Because as you know, in Sushruta's time, there was great difficulty in dissecting the human body. A recently dead body, it was again considered to be an act of defilement to go and touch it. These were all the taboos built around, which inhibited the growth of medicine. So Sushruta's method was to put this body in a river or a stream with a wooden frame, and as the body was rotting, then they would use sharp leaf tips and so on, a very crude type of dissection. Only the osteology, the bone, tendons and so on, could be really identified by that method. The soft tissue anatomy, in other words, was very defective. What we call the systemic anatomy, the anatomy of the skeleton, the anatomy of the tendons, etc., which resisted degeneration. It is fairly accurate in Sushruta's anatomy. But he recognized that the regional anatomy, for example, the ankle or the groin or the axilla, all these were defective. So he insisted that they must be learned during the process of surgery. And he described them as a series of marmas, the vital points. They are actually nothing more than regional anatomy. He also described 101 blunt instruments and 20 sharp instruments. Very elaborate descriptions are there. He says that these instruments must be made from good metal, and in fabricating these instruments, the manuals for those must be strictly followed. Obviously, there were manuals in those days about fabricating instruments. And procedures are described in very great detail, and post-operative care is also described. Next, please. Now here, just to that it was not theoretical, these are some of the positions described by Sushruta's in his, for example, this is a position for operating for urinary bladder stones, which was very common in the north, and for lithotomy operation, this is a position described by Sushruta, which is very similar to the lithotomy position we use today. Next, please. Now here, these are some of the instruments excavated near the Takshashila site, exactly what Sushruta had described, both blunt as well as sharp instruments. So they are not mere descriptions. These instruments really did exist. Next, please. Now, just to give an example of Sushruta's osteology, or the bones, the anatomy, this is Sushruta's description. This is the modern anatomy description. Now, if you look head and neck, Sushruta described 66, but the modern description is only 30, and the difference comes because Sushruta included teeth as well as the windpipe as part of the skeletal structures. That's why that difference came. Similarly, the trunk, the chest and so on, Sushruta described 128, but the modern description is only 50, and the difference is because he included the costal cartilages, some processes in the vertebrae. He considered them as independent bones. That's how it became 128. Like that, you will find 300 bones, his description, modern is 200, his description was 300. But there is a very good explanation why these differences came. So he was a very astute observer. There was no question about that. Next, please. Now, this is something of great interest. This is a picture which appeared in Gentleman's Magazine in 1858 in London. At that time, some doctors had come with the East India Company in India, and they had observed in the Maharashtra a man whose nose had been cut off. His nose was being reconstructed by a flap taken from his scalp. This was something unheard of in Europe, and this is the flap being rotated to reconstruct the nose. Now, this was apparently being practiced by a wandering practitioner in Maharashtra, and this doctor, who was so struck by this, he wrote an article and published in the Gentleman's Magazine in London, and this is a technique, exactly a description of Sushruta's rhinoplasty. This is the technique, even now it is known as Indian technique, that gives you the kind of surgeon that Sushruta was. Next, please. Now, there was another great figure, Charaka, who is said to have lived around 100 AD. He is said to have been the physician of Kanishka. And just to give you a sampling of his thinking, how the grandeur of his thinking, this is what Charaka says about science of life or Ayurveda. The science of life has always been in existence. It sounds so modern even today. And there have always been people who understood it in their own way. It is only with reference to its first systematized comprehension or instruction that it may be said to have a beginning. Now, it sounds so modern, but this is an exact literal translation of what Charaka says about Ayurveda. Another very great figure of in our Indian system of medicine. Next, please. Now, we leave that part, the great past of Indian medicine, As I said earlier, I shall not discuss the phase of decline, but now we are moving on to the renaissance of Western medicine, where it started, things started looking up in the West. Now, this was a great figure, Vesalius, just like Leonardo, he was a contemporary. He also marked a renaissance in medicine, and he published a great classic called The Fabric of the Human Body that laid the basis of modern anatomy. Vesalius, his Fabric of the Human Body, every structure, every description is based on very accurate dissection, and that laid the basis of modern medicine. Next, please. Now, then came the 16th century, a great figure, Ambrose Paré. He was a barber surgeon in France, worked mostly in the army. And Ambrose Paré, he brought about a certain reform in practice of surgery, devised all kinds of instruments, cauteries to stop bleeding and so on. And above all, even though he was not formally educated, he recognized the inadequacy of surgery, and he is credited with the famous saying, "I dressed the wounds, God healed them." It's a very philosophic statement. That was Ambrose Paré. Next, please. Now, this is a picture of the cauteries that he devised, because his problem was bleeding, amputations, all sorts of injuries on the battlefield, how to stop the bleeding. And these are the all sorts of cauteries which Ambrose Paré designed and got made. Of course, he did many other things. I won't go into it, but this is just to give you how innovative Ambrose Paré was. But in spite of Ambrose Paré, the surgical conditions in Europe in the 17th century, they were extremely unsatisfactory. Next, please. Now, this is an example. What I mean by that, the commonest operation in Europe in the 17th or even 18th century was amputation. Amputation of breast, amputation of limbs, often for the wrong reasons and done in the crudest possible manner without any anesthesia. Now, this is an example of how amputation of the breast used to be done. And in this somber world came a great figure. Next, please. That was John Hunter, who lived in the 18th century in England. And John Hunter is rightly credited with providing surgery with a scientific foundation. And John Hunter was a many-sided genius. He grappled with practically all problems in biology and medicine. Even today, whether we deal with clotting, whether we deal with digestion, we can always go back and find something which John Hunter had said of very great significance. In fact, this quotation itself, "Why think? Why not do the experiment?" This is a classic saying of John Hunter, and the occasion for this was his pupil was Jenner, some of you must have heard, who introduced vaccination. Now, Jenner set up a practice in Gloucestershire in England, and there he found the great, one of the commonest cause of death was smallpox in those days in the UK. And he found that these milkmaids who had cowpox, they were immune from smallpox. When he heard this, he wrote a long letter to his mentor, John Hunter, reporting this observation and also giving a whole lot of theories why this may or may not be correct, or how this may or may not be correct. John Hunter read this long letter and he sent him a postcard saying, "My dear Jenner, why think? Why not try the experiment?" This was John Hunter's famous statement. Next, please. Now, these are the contributions of John Hunter, the beginnings of modern surgery, if I may put it. One was comparative anatomy. It was impossible for John Hunter to think of the anatomy of the stomach or the brain or the shoulder or any part of the body without looking at the analogues in the animals. For example, the shoulder joint in man. What about the shoulder joint in the frog or in the monkey and so on? So he had long before Darwin, he had a view of comparative anatomy, how these organs evolved. And he also came to the remarkable conclusion that the evolution of anatomy, the determinant was function. The shoulder joint of the monkey and the shoulder joint of man, they are different because the function of the shoulder, they are entirely different in the monkey and in man. For example, the design of the lower limb and the upper limb. Look at the hip joint. There is also a ball and socket joint. So is the shoulder joint. They are different because the function of the lower limb is stability. It has got to support us. So it has to be stable. Whereas the arm, it is mobility. So therefore, the shoulder joint, even though it is ball and socket joint, its anatomy is different. And the key to that is function. Now, this was John Hunter's famous contribution, a great conceptual revolution, if I may put it. Second was the experimental approach. There was a problem, you have to find an answer for it in experiment. This had very profound consequences, as I mentioned earlier. And lastly, he introduced a whole series of new techniques in surgery, whether it was treating aneurysms or whether it was treating somebody in respiratory failure. He had an innovative mind. Next, please. Now, then came the 19th century. Now, that was a very important phase. And the most important things which happened, one was the advent of public health. The Chadwick Report came in that century. It was realized that how to treat sewage, there must be covered drains, clean water supply. These concepts, which we take it so much for granted, they came in the 19th century. In fact, it is interesting, the first public health officer was appointed in Liverpool, Dr. Duncan. That was the first time anywhere in the world a doctor being appointed as public health officer by a municipality. And you will be interested to hear, the greatest opposition for this came from the medical community. Because their argument was, treating the diseases is our job. The municipality has nothing to do with it. There is no reason for the municipality to get into health affairs. Now, that gives you how difficult it was for public health concepts to be accepted at that time. But it made a big change in the conditions in hospital, ensuring cleanliness and making medicine safe for patients. Next came anesthesia. I don't have to tell you what the condition must have been for the patient before the advent of anesthesia, how barbaric the conditions must have been. So this was undoubtedly the greatest contribution in human altruism, if you ask me, to make surgery and medicine painless for the patient. And lastly, antisepsis. We shall see about it later. More patients used to die from hospital infection than from the disease itself, as some of the observers pointed out. And antisepsis introduced by Lister, that marked a revolution in the practice of medicine. And these were the three major developments which revolutionized medicine. They were something like the tuning of an orchestra. If you go and listen to an orchestra which is about to play a symphony, you hear these sounds, the sound of music, not necessarily coordinated, sometimes even discordant, but there is an expectant air because we know the great symphony is going to come. Similarly, these three developments were the tuning of the medical orchestra. And the great orchestra was to be played in the 20th century, and that was with the entry of sciences. Already the beginnings could be seen, like Röntgen rays, which came towards the end of the 19th century. The X-rays came, so that we could see anatomy, living anatomy. Similarly, ophthalmoscope came, Helmholtz's great contribution. Radiation came, Curie's, and so on. So physical and chemical sciences coming slowly and making their impact felt on medicine. That was the real great symphony, the full symphony to be heard in the following century. Next, please. Now, these are some of the pictures. This is the anesthesia, a famous scene in the Massachusetts General Hospital. A patient with a tumor of the jaw was being operated, and the surgeon was Warren, who was highly skeptical of this newfangled thing called anesthesia. And the anesthetist was Wells. He was giving nitrous oxide for anesthesia. Incidentally, nitrous oxide had been discovered by Humphrey Davy in England, but at that time it was used more for, in clubs, people used to inhale this. It was called nitrous oxide folly, something like our cocktails today. That was all the significance of nitrous oxide at that time. But it was to the credit of Wells, he found the anesthetic potential for nitrous oxide. And this was used for this patient whose tumor of the jaw was removed. And when it was successfully done, Warren exclaimed to the people who had assembled to watch the operation, the famous words, "Gentlemen, this is no humbug." That is the scene here. Next, please. Now, here is Lister, an immortal figure in the history of surgery who introduced antisepsis. When Lister started practicing surgery in Glasgow, the mortality from amputations, the commonest operation at that time, was 70 to 75%. And this stung his conscience. He was a tender-hearted person, a Quaker, who was deeply hurt by this very high mortality. And he knew that in Carlisle, to clear the sewage, they were using carbolic. And he also knew of Pasteur's great work in France on microbes. So he thought, why not try that? So he introduced what is called the carbolic engine. Next, please. So this is the use of the carbolic engine here. Next, please.
which greatly reduced the mortality. Now, I talked about the advent of science and technology. What did it do to medicine? Now we are coming to the 20th century. Now I have taken my own specialty, cardiac surgery. Now if you look prior to 1950, all that cardiac surgery had was basically two operations. One was what is called closed mitral valvotomy. We put a finger and opened a narrowed valve, which is the commonest operation even today. And another was closing patent ductus arteriosus, a very simple operation. It is not really inside the heart. It is in the neighborhood of the heart. These were the only two operations which existed prior to 1950. And the basis for these two operations were the surgical ingenuity, the sheer ingenuity of the surgeon, the manual skill, and also the daring of the surgeon, because it was no joke. Today what is being done by our trainees, closed mitral valvotomy, if you look at the history how Bailey introduced this operation, one can only stand in admiration of the daring of the surgeon, how many patients he lost, and how he kept on trying and succeeded in making this simple operation acceptable. But since 1950, see what has happened in the field of cardiac surgery. We have heart-lung bypass, which is the basis of all open-heart operations. And look at the mechanical pumps are being used. Gas-liquid mass transfer, which is part of chemical engineering, that is being used in the oxygenator. We use valves for replacing diseased valves, and they use material science, fluid dynamics, and fabrication technology. Then we have pacemakers, which have given a new life to hundreds of thousands of patients. We have to have an energy source, new batteries of lithium, electronics. We need chips for that, programmable pacemakers. And again, we need material science. Then we have transplantation of the heart. We need modern immunology, immunosuppressants for pharmaceutical chemistry. You can see the science and technology which has gone and the great revolution which has been brought about in cardiac surgery. Now, this is really true for all other specialties in surgery. This is just to give you an example how science and technology ferments medicine. Next please. Now, I thought in looking at the science and technology applications in medicine, I'll give a simple list of what we have. It's an enormous field, as you can well imagine. We have a very large field of instruments. Any hospital you go, you will see them. Even dispensaries, you will see them. And they may be diagnostic instruments, or they may be monitoring instruments of all varieties of complexity. Then we have imaging instruments. We will go into them later one by one. And then there are therapeutic instruments, instruments which are not only used for imaging or diagnosis, which actually intervene in improving the patient's condition. Then we have another category called devices. They may be implants, permanently implanted in the body, or they may be disposables, used once and thrown away. They come in contact with the body tissues, but they are not implanted inside. And lastly, there are external prostheses, like an artificial limb or a denture, which are really not inside the body, but they are permanently used, make life livable. And lastly, a new emerging field, biotechnology products, we shall have something to say about it. So these are the three major categories. Now, instruments basically depend on electronics and computers, whereas devices, they depend on material science and engineering sciences. And biotechnology depends on modern biology. These are the basic differences in these three, among these categories. Next, please. We shall go one by one. Now, if you look at the diagnostic and monitoring instruments, all of you know the blood pressure apparatus, very commonly used. Or a little more sophisticated, not so often used except in very specialized hospitals, a Doppler blood flow monitor. In special situations, it is necessary. But there we use principles of fluid dynamics. Now, then we have a whole series of instruments, electrocardiogram, electroencephalogram, electromyogram. All these are based on principles of bioelectricity. We have all manner of equipment in these, and without which practice of modern medicine is impossible. Next, please. Then we come to diagnostic instruments in imaging. That's a big field in itself. Radiology nowadays, they call it radiology and imagiology, because it has become so large today. One is the CT scan. We had previously X-rays, but this is a later version of X-rays, CT scan, computerized tomography. We shall see later. Then we have all series of endoscopes. There is practically every chamber in the body can be looked into today, whether it is the stomach, whether it is the urinary bladder, whether it is the blood vessels, whether it is the heart itself. So we have endoscopes today with which, using principles of optics, optical fibers are necessary, we can peer into the body chambers. Then we have, using nuclear physics, we have magnetic resonance imaging, magnetoencephalogram, radionuclide angiography, radionuclide cardiography, etc. Again, getting a nuclear image of the organs. And lastly, we have echocardiography using ultrasonic Doppler. Ultrasound is extensively used nowadays. It has really brought about a revolution in cardiology in particular, where we used to have complicated angiography where a patient has to be anesthetized, catheters being passed into the heart to get an idea of the cardiac chambers, anatomy, and so on. All this information today, or most of it, can be obtained without any kind of an invasive procedure by using echocardiography, simply putting the transducer on the chest, and we can virtually see the interior of the heart. Next, please. Then, as I mentioned, we have therapeutic instruments which actually intervene, and the examples are defibrillators. Ventricular fibrillation of the heart fibrillates instead of beating, that is tantamount to death. It is no longer beating. Now, that by simply administering a shock, very often it can be brought back to normal rhythm, which is after cardiac surgery, we use it routinely. That is a defibrillator. Then we have pacemakers, about which I mentioned earlier. So these are biostimulators, basically. There are many other kinds. I'm just giving some typical examples. Other types of intervention, they use radiation. And the examples are medical lasers, a newly emerging field. Earlier on, laser was used for cancer surgery, for example. But nowadays, it is being used for ablating structures which are blocking an artery. For example, an artery going to the leg, let us say. It is narrowed by atherosclerosis. A man finds it difficult to walk because the artery is getting narrowed. So even 20 years ago, we had to do an operation for it. Even today, most hospitals in India, they will have to do a fairly complicated operation to overcome that obstruction of a blood vessel artery going to the leg. But it is possible in many of these using a laser catheter to re-establish that channel. In our own hospital, we are doing this. So that is an example of intervention by using radiation. Then radiotherapy equipment, which is used extensively in cancer treatment. And lastly, there is a new category called assist devices, mostly used in the heart, a failing heart, where we cannot get an immediate heart for transplantation, or following a heart attack, the man goes into severe heart failure. If you can survive, then first 4 or 5 days, maybe the heart might recover. Under those circumstances, support can be provided by using what are called assist devices. Now, this uses electronics, it uses material science, it uses fluid dynamics. It is a hybrid technology, if I may use that term. That is also an example of intervention. Next, please. Then we have now left instrumentation, we are moving on to devices. Now, this is a field which has really grown by default. Instrumentation, everybody knows, whereas devices, they are not so well recognized. And yet, they are so very important. The global market for devices, there was an estimate in the United States 3 years ago, was $10 billion. And in India alone, because our institute has a special interest in this technology, we made a market survey in 1986, and the demand for medical devices at that time was 360 crores of rupees. And the growth estimated was by 2000 AD, the devices market in India will be 1000 crores. And nowadays, industry sources tell me that it is a gross underestimate. Now, be that as it may, it is of very great importance. Now, here, the implants, some of the examples are hip joint or heart valve, implantable lens, or vascular graft for blocked arteries you can replace with plastic tubes. These are all permanent implants. Then we have disposables, like blood bag. If you want to collect blood, no longer bottles are being used because, as you all know, bottles, it's difficult to clean them, and you cannot separate the blood components by using bottles. It takes a lot of space, difficult to transport, and so on. So blood bags replaced bottles long ago in the West. It is only now that it has come into India, but that is used and thrown away. Then we have oxygenators, a little more sophisticated. Now here the venous blood from the patient is oxygenated in this device. The carbon dioxide is removed, oxygen is added. This is used in open heart surgery, and syringes. Now, all these, whether they are implants or disposables, the materials which are used, whether they are plastics or metals or ceramics, they have to be compatible with the body tissues. That is what makes it so very highly specialized. It requires a lot of doing to develop these materials and to fabricate them in a very special manner. Then lastly, we have external prostheses, the artificial limbs and the dentures. Next, please. And lastly, we have biotechnology applications. This is the newest entrant. Many people predict that the 20th century we had electronics and computers, physical sciences on dominating medicine, but 21st century will be the century of modern biology. Now, this is because the diagnostic kits we have today, or hormones, enzymes made by recombinant DNA techniques. This is a very profound development, because in our own days, for example, vaccines were made by taking the bacterial antigen, injecting it into a horse or a rabbit, and they produce the antibody, and this is what we have been using all along. That is the antisera made from animals. But it was true that this could produce reaction in human beings, and occasionally we might even lose a patient from this serum reaction. But it was a dream. How can you make the human being to produce this serum? It was not possible. But today it is possible, and that is a very great contribution of modern biology, because as you know, today's modern biology has shown that two somatic cells can fuse. When I was a student in the medical college, if somebody said two somatic cells could fuse, it would have been considered scientific nonsense. But Milstein's great contribution a few years ago, that two cells could fuse. Now, what are these two cells? You all know, if a particular bacterial antigen is exposed to a lymphocyte, and lymphocyte in the body is an immunocyte, that is the cell which is responsible for our immunity. I'm simplifying a little bit so that you can understand it. Now, this lymphocyte, the moment it is exposed to an antigen, that antigenic memory is enshrined in that cell. It is immediately inscribed there. And based on that, that information is conveyed to another, a sister cell, which begins to produce an antibody, which is exactly fitting that particular antigen. It is highly specific. But the production capacity is very low. That's where the rabbit and so on, the serum that you get is so tiny in quantity, it was uneconomic really. But Milstein's work was, if you take a lymphocyte and expose it to a particular antigen, that memory is inscribed in it, in its genome. Now, let us say if you take that lymphocyte, now you can fuse it with a cell which keeps on producing protein of very high purity. Now, there is a particular tumor in the body called myeloma. Now, this tumor, which was known for a very long time, and this tumor produces a protein of very high purity, a globulin. It is a single peak in the electrophoresis in very large quantities. It is a type of cancer because it is a factory producing this protein far beyond what the body needs. Now, Milstein's work was, if you took this myeloma cell and fused it with the lymphocyte, a strange thing happens. That new cell which results from this fusion, which is called hybridoma, it has the immunologic memory of that lymphocyte. It has the productive capacity of that myeloma cell. Now, that hybridoma, therefore, is expressing the human genome is expressing here. It is basically the human globulin that is being produced. So here, that antibody, antiserum, is highly specific. It will not produce the kind of reactions with the animal sera would produce. So therefore, that is one example of what modern biology has done. And the same technique, the hybridoma, is used in diagnostic kits. For example, for diseases, you can have the antigen characteristic of that disease. You can use the same technique and develop an antibody, which becomes the heart of the diagnostic kit, which are being produced in great numbers abroad, and even in India it is being produced today. So the diagnostic kits using hybridoma, the vaccines using hybridoma technology, and again using this recombinant DNA technology, then cryopreservation of tissues, these are all new developments as a result of advances in modern biology. Now, this definitely in the 21st century will have a profound impact on the practice of medicine. Next, please. Now, I have just given a catalog of all the advances of technology. What are the scientific basis of this? This is a CT scan which many of you would have seen. Here is the gantry. The patient is having a head scanning done here. Now the basis of this is really physical sciences. Next, please. Now here is a CT scan. Dr. Verma is here. He will immediately recognize this is a meningioma in a patient. The problem with the plain X-ray, it could not really differentiate the soft tissue structures too much. And also the different layers in depth, they were superposed one on the other. So the precision in diagnosis was not available with plain X-rays. Whereas in a CT scan, hundreds of such images are integrated into a single image by a computerized tomography. So you get an image something like this, which in olden days, before the CT scanning, even when our institute started, there would have to be air encephalography and other various unpleasant investigations to make a diagnosis. Today it has become extremely simple by using CT scanning, which is a contribution of physical sciences to medicine. And what about chemical sciences? Next, please. All of you know about pharmaceutical chemistry. I won't go into it. I'll take something which is not so well known, that is polymer chemistry. Now here is, if you look at the vascular surgery, people have been searching for a replacement for blocked arteries for a very long time. Whether it is artery to the leg, artery to the kidney, artery to the heart or to the brain, it has been a problem. These arteries, the man is as old as his arteries. Arteries begin to age, they get clogged. So can we do something? Now this effort started for a very long time, or 100 years people have been trying. Say for example, all sorts of things, I won't get into it. Many great figures have tried, for example, Alexis Carrel, who got Nobel Prize. He also was working on this in the early years of the present century. But the real advance came with a man called Voorhees. And Voorhees introduced what is nylon grafts. Now, nylon was the first man-made fiber, because all the other methods which had been tried earlier, whether it was using the vein taken from a cadaver, or aluminum tubes, all sorts of things had been tried. They all clotted very quickly. So results were very unsatisfactory. The first long-term patency was obtained by Voorhees by using a porous graft. That was an extraordinary thing. And how did he do this? Next, please. It's an interesting story because nylon, as some of you know, there was a remarkable man called Carothers. He did some thousands of experiments. It's a classic story in polymer chemistry to invent a man-made fiber. And finally he succeeded, that was nylon. And as soon as nylon came, it was used in the war applications for making parachutes. Voorhees was a vascular surgeon in New York. He was sitting out on his lawn one day and he saw his parachutes coming down. He was used to his failures using all kinds of tubes. Then he told his wife, why not I try this material? It is something very new. So he went and bought some nylon, which was called Orlon in those days. His wife stitched a tube of Orlon and he used it in a patient. In those days, there were no ethics committees, no FDA, so surgeons could do whatever they pleased. So this was this is an example of a porous tube, not nylon incidentally, but that stayed open for prolonged periods. But later on it was found that this nylon was not very good, because slowly the nylon begins to degrade in the body, its yield strength begins to deteriorate, so later on the polyester fiber came. Now today, we are using polyester grafts all over the world, and literally hundreds and thousands of people owe their life or their limbs to these grafts. Now this is an example of a graft which is used all over India, everywhere. And this is a crimped graft, an example of what polymer chemistry has done in vascular surgery. But it has much more extensive applications. Next, please. I'll simply show you what polymer chemistry has done. Look at acrylics used in bone cements, dentures, etc. Hydrogels, which are used in contact lenses. Cellulosics are used in membranes in kidney. Polyesters in vascular grafts, as I mentioned. Nylon, not too much used nowadays, except in disposable throwaway applications. Deldrin, which is used in heart valves even now. Artificial kidneys, it is used. Next, please. Then we go on to polyethylene, which is used, this ultra-high molecular weight polyethylene, which is used in knee joint prosthesis. Polypropylene is used again in joints. Polyvinyl chloride in disposable applications like blood bags, oxygenators. Polyurethanes are used in sutures. Again, in grafts, polyurethane is used. Silicones are used in plastic surgery as organ enhancement, replacement. Teflon, again, is used in catheters in orthopedics. So I just wanted to show you practically no branch of polymer chemistry is excluded from application and no branch of medicine is excluded. This just gives you how extensive the contribution of chemical sciences to medicine is. Next, please. Then we come to engineering sciences. Now here is the picture of John Gibbon, who introduced open heart surgery. I show it for one reason, because I worked under him many years ago, a very great man, who worked for 20 years in the laboratory to develop the what is called heart-lung machine, a machine which will function as the heart and the lung. Gibbon, when he was a medical student, if I may be permitted to say 1 minute on him, as a medical student, he saw a patient die in Boston until he developed an oxygenator which functioned as a lung and a simple roller pump. And that was the beginning of the Gibbon heart-lung machine. 1953, he brought it back to patients in Philadelphia. He did the first open heart operation in closing the hole in the heart of a woman. Next, please. Now, here is the first Gibbon machine. It is very highly, it is cumbersome. By today's standards, it would be considered very crude. Now, here, what really happens is the patient's blood, venous blood, is taken from there. It is, a pump is used to take it and bring it into this huge, monstrous-looking machine. It is a vertical screen oxygenator taking large quantities of blood to prime. I have seen this machine being used. Something like 7 liters of blood are required to prime this. And of course, the oxygenated blood is pumped back into the patient. But historically, this was the first heart-lung machine. Next, please. Now, this is the first oxygenator which Gibbon used. Next, please. I just want to show you to what extent technology has moved. Today, Gibbon's oxygenator is of historic importance only. Today, this is the oxygenator. It is a sleek-looking plastic disposable oxygenator. It does exactly the same thing. Next, please. If you take a section of that, what really happens is the venous blood from the patient enters through this port and it goes up in this column. This is a bubble chimney. As the venous blood goes up, oxygen is bubbled through that column. And as you know, the hemoglobin, or the red pigment in our blood, has a great affinity for oxygen. By the time the blood reaches the top of this chimney, it is fully oxygenated. Carbon dioxide has been released. But it is frothy blood. You cannot put it back into the patient. So that frothy blood overflows and comes into this next chamber. What you see here, this shaded area, that is a plastic coated with an antifoam substance, a silicone, which breaks up all these bubbles. Now, what settles here is oxygenated blood minus the bubbles. That is pumped back into the patient. What you see here is a heat exchanger, because often when you do this operation, we want to electively cool the patient, or we may want to warm the patient. Now, this heat exchanger is integrated into this oxygenator. Now, this is a sleek oxygenator, which incidentally is the one which we have developed, which is going to be produced in Madras from next month. Next, please. Now, this is actually the oxygenator in use in the operating room. This is the oxygenator. And this is a companion device called a cardiotum reservoir, which is the blood sucked out from the heart. That also we have to remove the bubbles, etc. But it doesn't have any oxygenating function. It is a simpler device. But it always goes with this. So these are the two devices in actual use in the theater. Next, please. Now we come to the heart valve, another contribution of engineering science and material science. This is our heart valve, incidentally. Now this is the, just to give you an idea, this metallic housing is made of a chrome cobalt alloy, which is called Haynes alloy, which is biocompatible, it is durable. And this tilting disc is made of ultra-high molecular weight polyethylene, a very difficult plastic to machine. And we have to use what is called cryo-machining. It is frozen, made hard, and then it is machined. That keeps tilting up to 70 degrees, so that as the pressure rises in the proximal chamber, the valve is forced open and blood flows. Now, this is the sewing ring made of polyester through which the surgeon puts the stitches. Next, please. Now, this is the first valve operation which we did using our valve. It's about a year ago. This is the aortic valve in the closed position. Next, please. This is the aortic valve in the open position. Now, this incidentally will be produced in Bangalore, in this very same city. Next, please. Now, if you look at these are all the great advances we are talking about. What about the ground realities in India? It is very fine to talk about heart valves, oxygenators, but what is happening on the ground? Now here it is interesting to look at our minor public health centers. Now here, this is in Kerala at any rate, it varies from state to state, but there is a basic commonality in all this. In Kerala, this is what is prescribed or said to be available in the primary health centers. Electrical equipment, a refrigerator and sterilizer are expected to be available. Mechanical equipment, blood pressure apparatus, an examination table, thermometer, dressing drum, scalpel, artery forceps. Not much of surgery is done, as you know, in the primary health centers. Gloves, dressings and syringes. I just want to show you for these slides for many reasons. If you talk about syringes, for example, very often there is an impression this high technology in medicine, etc., is only for the affluent and the rich people. We don't need all that. All we need is holistic medicine, promotive, preventive. We don't need any technology. I just want to point out to you, this is highly misleading, because if you want the villager to have safe injections, you have to have disposable syringes. There is no reason why he should be getting injections with glass syringes which are poorly sterilized, and he should be subjected to infection or AIDS or what have you. And if you need disposable syringes, I put it to you that you need high technology. Even today, India does not have an indigenous technology for making disposable syringes. Just one example. Next, please. Now, then we go on to the secondary level institutions, taluk hospitals, which are expected to have 200 beds, or district hospitals, which are expected to have 500 beds. Now, there surgery is done. Now, there the electrical equipment, a cautery is necessary. A ventilator is expected to be available. Now, the sophistication is increasing now. Electrocardiogram should be available. X-ray equipment should be available for plain X-rays. Could be focused, this case. Then mechanical equipment, a Boyle's machine for giving anesthesia. Surgical instruments should be available. And even many district hospitals in Kerala, they offer specialties. So therefore, for gynecology or ENT and so on, so specialty instruments should be available. If you look at the devices, blood bags should be available because blood transfusion is often used. Now in this, I am leaving out drugs and vaccines and so on. Now here you can see for a district hospital or a taluk hospital, the technology is required, whether it is blood bag, whether it is Boyle's machine, or whether it is a ventilator, these are all products of high technology. And we have very little of it in India. We do not have a base. So if you mean to offer good quality care, I don't mean high quality, good quality care at the taluk or district level, it is impossible to do it without technology. Next, please. Now we come to the tertiary level institutions. The primary and secondary levels in India, they differ vastly from the primary and secondary levels in the developed countries. Like, for example, if you take a county hospital in the United States or Germany, their standards are entirely different from our taluk and district hospitals. But if you take the tertiary level institutions, of which we have a crop in India, you will find instruments. Look at them, BP apparatus, ECG, EMG, auto analyzer, imaging, we have a whole lot of them, CT scan, MRI, echo equipment, radionuclide equipment. Then we come to devices, the whole lot of things. These are all available today in tertiary level institutions in India, including ours. Now there you find that the gap between Indian tertiary level institutions and the Western tertiary level institutions is very narrow. We have practically closed that gap. Not fully, but substantially. Whereas at primary and secondary levels, the gap is extremely wide. But here again, the technology, we have to depend on other countries. Next, please. So the Indian, then we come to, of course, this is a continuation of the tertiary level institutions, like therapeutic defibrillator, etc. All these are available today in India, including intra-aortic balloon pumping, medical lasers. These we are able to offer in India based on foreign technology. Next, please. So therefore, if you look at the Indian scenario, what strikes us is the near total dependence on imports. All these that we have mentioned, starting from the primary level, with increasing dependence as we go towards the tertiary level. The second, we have very little market intelligence, the requirement for this. How many autoclaves do we really need? We have very little information on this. In devices, we have done a little bit of survey, but the entire field, it has not been surveyed. Thirdly, we have no proper legislation. It is extraordinary that countries like Sri Lanka and Nigeria, they have devices legislation. But in India, we do not have a devices legislation. so that anybody can make any device, whether it is a denture or a hip prosthesis, and sell it, and there is no way we can stop them. If the man dies from it, you can sue him for manslaughter. That's a different matter. But there is no devices legislation in India. It only shows our traditional inability in our culture to define the limits of our tolerance. We will accept anything. So that is reflected here also. And lastly, because of this, poor quality devices and instruments are freely being sold. Next, please. Therefore, it is clear, with the increasing demand, the pressure from the public, from the consumer fora, we have to do something. We have to do the research and development here. We cannot keep on depending on foreign R&D forever. But then, what are the hurdles in this development? And there are many. First is an R&D culture in industry. In Western countries, where much of the R&D work is done, almost all of it is done by the private sector industries. Whereas in India, the R&D is a stranger to industry. Second, to develop medical technology, we need close and continuing interaction between medical profession, engineering, and other branches. Now, that kind of multidisciplinary groups which will continuously interact, it is extremely difficult to form such groups in India. We have vertical growth, but we have very little of cross reaction. Then we have the great problem of lab to the industry, to the factory, that gap. Things are developed in the laboratory, which all of you are familiar, it's not only something special to medicine, but in other areas also you have. Technologies are developed, but for a variety of reasons, they fail to get transferred to the factory. Then we have consumer resistance. This is a slightly misleading. What I mean by that is, a technology developed in India, the users, in this case doctors, there is great resistance to using Indian technology. And that is because basically we lack confidence in ourselves. Confidence in our technology, confidence in ourselves. And the roots of this can be found really because we are mentally not decolonized. That's the only thing I can say. A technology which is effective, which satisfies all the international standards, still you will find people will prefer to use something made. Even in Portugal we are willing to use it, or Brazil, but there is great hesitation to using something developed in India. Now that is a problem which has to deal with by Professor Kapoor, will have to deal with it. Perhaps it will take 200 years for us to become mentally decolonized. And lastly, of course, there is a great pressure from multinational and their Indian agents, the distributors. It's an extremely powerful lobby which will try to thwart the development of Indian technology at every conceivable stage. And some of these I speak from personal experience in Trivandrum. Next, please. Therefore, it is necessary a new strategy for solving this problem. Something like a medical technology board, whatever we may call it, we need to form it. And the inputs must come from R&D institutions, national laboratories, etc. The government must come and industry must come as an equal partner. But each of these, not only that to industry to give money, but they can provide that lab to the factory gap. It can be closed only if the industry is interacting during the R&D phase. We have found that it is not just the supply of funds that the industry can help. We have found in our own developing the oxygenator and so on, if the industry is interacting with us from the design stage itself, there are many suggestions they can give from the scaling up point of view. Look, if you adopt this suggestion, it will make it easier for us to produce it. Now, that kind of suggestion is extremely valuable during the design stage itself. So it is absolutely necessary that industry interacts as an equal partner at this stage itself. The government, again, not only they must provide funds, they have to do something about providing the regulatory authority, that a certain legislation, the standards are prescribed, and only devices which fulfill those standards are produced in the country. That is their role. And of course, R&D institutes have to come out with the ideas, with the drive to make these things. And of course, next, please. Now, as we forge ahead with technological development, there are certain problems we must be aware of, particularly in a field like medicine. As the machines develop, the physician is distanced more and more from the patient. The machine quite literally comes between the patient and the physician. This is a serious problem which the physicians must be constantly aware of. We need the machines, but we must always be conscious that machines are only means to helping the patient. The second machines tend to escalate the cost, about which I shall have something to say in a minute, because this may put it beyond the reach of most of the patients. Then the medical industry complex, there is a danger as the interaction proceeds, our interests become convergent and profit becomes a main motivation, and this may work to the detriment of poor patients. Neurodevelopments, whether it is textile, everywhere this is happening. You may find new devices being made, like cars, for example. It is not that we need such a highly sophisticated car, but the consumerism. Now, that is a problem which one must be aware of, because eventually the benefits must go to the patient, so the cost reduction must remain very important, and this is what the physician must remember all the time. Next, please. Now, in dealing with these semi-ethical issues, I thought I should bring this Lewis Thomas, a very perceptive scientist and writer. He has pointed out that there are three types of technologies. One is the high technology of medicine. Now, the high technology, the common understanding or misunderstanding is transplantation, magnetoencephalogram. These are all regarded as the high technology of medicine. Actually, they are not. This is what Lewis Thomas points out. The basic technology is something like polio vaccine or penicillin. It comes from a proper understanding of the mechanisms of disease. And the methods of control are tailored precisely to the mechanisms of the disease. Now, whenever such remedies become available, they are always cheap. They are very simple. That is the real high technology of medicine, which is a product of science. Whereas what we are seeing as the dramatic, the glamorous, the sensational ones, some of which I have outlined here, including the heart valve, these are all what we would call halfway technologies, because we are basically dealing with the disease which has run its course. The storm has blown, the debris is left behind. We are doing a salvage operation. That is what we are calling the halfway technology. And lastly, there is something called non-technology, where none of these is necessary. What we require is sympathy, understanding, comforting words. That is non-technology, but it is a very great role in the practice of medicine. So, in assigning our priorities, in allocating our funds, it is very necessary to remember we have to give a fair share to science so that we have advances like hybridoma, the biological, the basis of the disease and the basis of its control. And we must invest substantially in this so that we have real high technology development which will be cost effective, which will be simple, which will be humane. At the same time, that will take a long time. We need answers immediately. It is necessary to invest in what we would call halfway technology. That also is necessary. These priorities must be kept in mind. Next, please. There is one more slide. That with that medicine also, the practice of medicine, we need technology, we need advances, we need science. But more than any of these, there is one that is required. And Charaka says in his own beautiful language that first, this slide, it is a quotation from Charaka Samhita. Natmartham, napi kamartham, atha bhutadayam prati. This is what he says. It is not for self-aggrandizement, whether it is self or nation. That is not the main motivation for medicine. Nor is it for pleasure. It is bhutadaya, it is compassion. Now, I think in developing science and technology for medical applications, this should be the watchword. The moment we have advances minus compassion, it has really essentially no meaning. I think I can put it in no better words than Charaka. Thank you very much for your attention.
We have stored blood and blood components. It has to be kept at 4 degrees centigrade. And if there is an interruption for, say, 3 hours, much of it can be wasted. So we connect it to our generator. Yes, yes. Of course, this is a waste of funds, but we have no other choice. In fact, we have even to have independent water supply, not only electricity. Preventive medicine, yes. Is the first organized experiment in this direction. IITs, for example, they have tried, I myself tried 1 year as a professor in an institute of technology, Indian Institute of Technology. But I found in the biomedical engineering department,
These are basically what I found, with no disrespect to them, highly intelligent people. They work in a so-called bioengineering department. They are playing games like modeling phenomena, cardiovascular phenomena, this, that. It is out of touch with reality. It is out of touch with the problems of the patient. With the result, they wither away, these departments. If you go to the medical colleges, they are completely innocent of any engineering or physics or science for that matter. That is how we are trained. We are trained as basic doctors. So, how do you link these two? In our present system today, neither in the engineering or IITs included or medical colleges, there is any provision for such interaction. So, in our institute, I felt in India we need a new structure, because the Western method is very different. The R&D work is all done by industry. Their profit is the motivation. And they come up with ideas, they develop a prototype, they may give it to a university to do some testing, etc. That doesn't apply here. So we have tried in our institute, an institute of medical science and technology. We have doctors, we have engineers, we have a large technology wing. Problems are conceptualized by the hospital wing, whether it is a valve or an oxygenator or a blood bag. The development is done by the engineering group or material science group, with constant inputs being provided by the medical group. The testing being done in animals, veterinarians are involved, again medical people are involved. Changes, optimization of design is done in the light of these experiments. And final product is brought back to the hospital for trial again. Now that's a new experiment. But I can tell you from our experience, it is extremely difficult to promote such an interaction. Because among the medical scientists, we have about 50 of them, I doubt more than a dozen are really interested in that kind of interaction. So, but that is the only future for us. Because if we are to get out of this total dependence, we cannot develop everything that we need in the country. But even a substantial part of it, if we have to develop, if we have come on par with international standards, we can even export these, then that interaction has to be intensified. And we need many, many more Chitra models to be replicated in the country. That's the only way this is going to happen. Yes, please. Tertiary referral center. We deal with cardiac and neuro problems, which are referred to us from many other hospitals. That's all we do. But the hospital, apart from providing the service, it has a very important role. It provides the medical inputs for the technology development. What we are doing is, we cannot set up, say, rural extension service. We cannot. Because our institute is under the Department of Science and Technology, our role is different. But what we do plan to do now, we are setting up what is called, in the name of our previous Chief Minister, Achyutamenon, who was instrumental in developing our institute. Without him, this institute would not have come. Now, named after him, we are going to set up an institute, a unit, called Achyutamenon Center for Health Science Studies. And now there, like taking Kerala again as a model, we have these problems at taluk and district levels. What is happening today, I'm sure this is happening elsewhere also, the government hospitals are literally dying. They are in a state of advanced decay. Even proper sanitation is not there. The beds are all creaking. Proper linen is not available. Leave aside the question of drugs and so on. This is the condition today. Whereas private hospitals are flourishing, at least in Kerala. In Trivandrum today, in Kerala as a whole, the beds in the private sector is more than twice that in the government sector. And they are growing very rapidly with bank finance and so on. Now, a large number of people are forced to go to these government hospitals. How can we look after them? It's a different orbit. The present system through the DHS mechanism is unworkable. That is what I have found. Now, is there some other model to make them work? Now, that is where we feel we have requested Professor K.M. Raj, a very eminent economist. He is preparing a project report for this center. We had told him, generally, economists, I heard once Professor Vaidyanathan, I find his name, he must have come and talked to you here. I heard Professor Vaidyanathan give a lecture a couple of years ago. He said, well, you don't ask us to prescribe. We study problems, we analyze the problems according to our methodology, and we give you an exact picture of what is happening. But don't ask us to prescribe. I remember he saying that. That is fine. But we are doctors, we have to prescribe. A doctor who only makes a diagnosis is no doctor at all. So we feel in this Achyutamenon Center, we will go beyond analysis, taking one problem, one aspect of health science problem, that is the delivery question, we must have a model which is applicable at the taluk level. What we have found, it is only vague ideas, now we have to do really scientific studies on this. I have found in slum areas in Trivandrum, for example, we have areas what are called laksham vidu areas, extremely poor people, day laborers. Many of them, I have talked to them, they don't at all mind because the wages are high in Kerala. A manual laborer gets 45 rupees easily a day. Many of them don't at all mind giving 15 to 20 rupees a month if they can get ordinary health care. Not just heart surgery and so on. Like a safe delivery for a woman, or a child is having some problem, or an appendix operation, or he had a fracture that has to be set. All these common things we are talking about. If that can be done safely, a dental problem. Now children come with huge osteomyelitis of the jaw. It doesn't have to go to that level. It can be attended earlier. But today he doesn't get it. If he goes to the government hospital, there is a long queue. He cannot get any attention. Finally, when his turn comes, he is told, "Will you come tomorrow?" All the problems we are familiar with. So if we can have a parallel system, insurance companies incidentally are interested in this kind of experiment. I have found banks have a program called Innovative Banking. Some of the bankers have told me they'll be interested in funding something like this. So that if we have a model at the taluk level, maybe a hospital is set up, which will provide only these services. And the doctors are such and such, they are also given certain incentives. Apart from their monthly, they may be given something extra for every procedure. All this will be made attractive. But it is all fixed, nothing underhand. And people contribute a certain amount. Insurance company contributes. Like that, the source, the funding, it will be a no-profit, no-loss type of operation. Very little of bureaucracy. If such a system can come, a parallel system, and it is my belief, I have not worked out it is for the economists to do this, but I do think that such a system will work. And if such a thing can be made to work at the taluk level, I have a feeling, at least in the government of Kerala, they will be deeply interested in accepting such a role. Maybe the whole DHS mechanism may be disbanded, I hope, and change over to a totally new pattern.
Lecture. A few days ago, we had a couple of lectures on issues related to healthcare, in which we specifically looked at the healthcare of the community at large, and it was, I think, mentioned there that there is no reason to believe that high-tech medicine should not be available to the poor people of India. We had discussed this point, and you had brought very beautifully today the need for disposable syringes, for example, which is, I think, the right of any individual in the country. So, high-tech is an extremely important point in healthcare of people at large. The trouble often comes when high tech becomes the aim in itself, like the diagnostic master checkups, which are available all over the country now, where the technology itself becomes the aim and not really health. One point I would like to mention just before we close the session, Dr. Bellison, is the contribution of Indian medicine, which can still be possible. You know, you have said that it's been fossilized, but I think in Ayurveda we can still find a tremendous amount of rich input which can go into preventive medicine. The whole question of lifestyles we have to adopt to live healthy, which now the Western medicine is trying to pick up. But when you read the Ayurveda, there's so much given on how to live correctly. And I think if that can be transferred and added to the modern medicine, it will be a great and a very proud contribution from our continent, which is still available. With these few words, I, on your behalf, thank Dr. Vellayathan for coming along all the way from Trivandrum and giving us this talk. Thank you.